Willie Bentz is already speaking, so I'm going to switch over to that. Let's see here.
Big one. Was out on Beaver Valley last Tuesday afternoon, well into the evening. So first, just wanted to start off by really commending the excellent work done by our local fire departments, initially led by East Jefferson Fire and Rescue. We had help from Kitsap, a couple of fire departments in Kitsap County. And finally, that scene was mopped up and taken over by the Department of Natural Resources to end it all. So thank you to everyone for their hard work there, as well as the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, who was there on scene assisting. I think a lot of folks, their primary question about that was related to the emergency alerts that were sent. I know there was some confusion and some annoyance / frustration, as we had a number of reports of folks receiving those alerts multiple times over the next couple of days, surprisingly. So I wanted to address that real quickly. First of all, we used two different types of alerts during that event to let folks know that the road was going to be closed, avoid the area, and specifically for a couple of residents, close to 10 who were under evacuation orders that we were recommending that they were leaving, that for them to leave. First and foremost, we do have Nixl, and we activated Nixl, which is our subscription-based text alert system here in Jefferson County. And there actually are two levels to Nixl subscriptions. First and foremost, there's the advisory level. Those are the most common alerts that we send. Those are for primarily road closures and traffic accidents. We send those on a pretty routine basis at the request of fire departments or law enforcement. And we have about 3,000 people who've signed up for that specific level of our Nixl text alert system. Beyond that, there is the alert level, a little bit higher of a priority, a little bit more severe of a situation when we send those alerts at that level. We have about 9,000 people who've signed up for Nixl alerts. And that includes things like, I think one of the best examples of that was the tsunami advisory a year ago, January, when there was the volcano that erupted in Tonga. The entire coast was under a tsunami advisory. We wanted folks to stay off the beaches if at all possible. So then we upgraded the alert level within Nixl and notified about 9,000 people who've signed up for that level of our service. To change or edit your level within Nixl, you can go to Nixl's website and log into your account and choose what works best for you. I know not everyone wants the ongoing traffic notifications. They don't care about the road closures. They just want to know when something big is happening, and you can alter your settings appropriately. Nixl customer service can help you get into your account or set one up there. This fire, though, we needed a tool beyond our normal Nixl text alert subscription-based service, and it was actually the first time here in Jefferson County that we activated something called IPAWS, or the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. IPAWS is a FEMA program that local jurisdictions have access to, which allows us to activate two separate emergency alerting protocol. One is EAS, or the Emergency Alert System, and the other is WEA, W-E-A, or Wireless Emergency Alerts. The EAS system, it's the, this is a test of the emergency alert system that everyone knows and loves and is pretty familiar with. That's activated via radio and TV to alert folks of an impending situation. And then WEA, those are those push alert, amber alert style alerts that most folks got on their phone. Again, it was the first time we activated this system here in Jefferson County. Felt it was particularly important since we were evacuating folks from their homes, since there was big activity on a main artery in and out of Jefferson County. And we wanted to make sure that that hit as many people as possible. That is not a subscription-based service. That hits everyone who's connected to the local cell towers. You can turn that off if you don't want to receive those, but we really do recommend that you keep those on. Those come on automatically by default within your phones. We only sent two of those, the initial notice of the fire and then the all clear about 4 hours or so later, and didn't send any more beyond those two. However, folks were getting those alerts repeatedly over the course of the next several days. And we've identified two potential reasons for that. One is that a lot of folks by default in their phones, it's set up to incur regular reminders if you don't properly mark that message as read in your phone, to be really sure that you get that potentially life-saving emergency alert. So we saw folks have some success by actually going in and clearing the message or marking the message as read, or by going into those settings and turning the regular reminders of that emergency alert off. However, that worked for some people, not all. And there were some technical issues where folks were traveling and maybe hitting multiple cell towers. They were in and out of service and the message wasn't marked as read initially. And for reasons we're really not sure why, folks were getting that message three, maybe four times over the next couple of days. So we're looking into some reasons behind that, making sure that doesn't happen in the future. I know that was really frustrating for folks to receive the same message over and over again, especially late at night in some cases. But again, that IPAWS system is a potentially life-saving system. We appreciate everyone's patience, especially because using that system during this event, we were able to evacuate those residents out safely. The firefighters on scene managed to avoid any injuries, any property loss or destruction during that event. So all in all, a great success, just with a few minor hiccups that we're obviously learning and hoping to improve from. Last but certainly not least on that fire, I wanted to note that we do have three distinct evacuation levels we use here in Jefferson County. We didn't use this verbiage during this particular evacuation just to avoid any confusion, but during larger evacuations when there might be different levels of awareness needed, we use a level 1, 2, and 3 system here in Jefferson County, similar to a lot of what they use on the West Coast. That's basically get ready, get set, and go. A level 1 is there's no evacuation imminent, but you should be aware that there is indeed a fire and there's a possibility of an evacuation needed. Level 2 is get ready, get set. And that means you should be ready to evacuate at any given moment and that it's probable or potentially impending. So that's when you should start packing things up, make sure the car is ready to go, alert your family, and be ready and be set to actually leave at any moment. Finally, level 3, that is go, that is get out. We are advising you to evacuate. And that's what we were at for those few residents during Tuesday's fire. Under Washington state law, there's no such thing as an evacuation order. We're not compelling you or forcing you to leave your home. But when we do issue that level 3 evacuation order, it is highly advised for your own health and safety and the health and safety of your family that you do evacuate when recommended. So we were under level 3 for just those few homes. Thankfully, there was the slight possibility we were going to look at more. But again, due to the great work of our fire departments and partner agencies, they were able to get that under control before that happened. So all in all, I'm very appreciative of the hard work and the response from the citizens. I'm very appreciative for a little bit wetter weather this week as the humidity is up and we're getting some very light rain here in Jefferson County. So that's all I have on that particular incident. And I'm happy to take any additional questions.
Thank you, Willie. It's great. You know, I'd rather have too many warnings than not enough. So I appreciate you going into the kind of the extra text a little bit, but really appreciated getting them. I'm glad it worked out well. Any questions for Willie?
I just want to add that I was getting text messages of kudos for Willie from members of our first response team. So thanks for your work, Willie. I think some phrases were killing it, leading the way. So thanks for all your extra work on that one, Willie.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was a success in terms of quick containment and great partnership. I happened to be in a large group when the first Nixle came in, and there was, you know, quite a bit of concern. And I'm just curious how there was a typo, a word was left out in that initial Nixle that confused people. And we have tried to talk with Washington's State Department of Transportation. It seems like often when there something like this is happening, you know, I mean, it's a stressful situation, but putting out jargon or incomplete information is really challenging. Like, Is there some process improvement whereby, you know, multiple people are looking at a message before it goes out to ensure that it's clear, understandable to a person who's not involved in emergency response?
Yeah, well, part of the issue is that we are under a character count limit. We only have 90 characters for the WIA messaging. And then we do have 360 for the expanded message. So we're really trying to carefully choose every single letter that goes into that message. So often each message does take, goes through a couple different draft forms here as we're trying to get that out. There's also the time constraint. So while we did have a couple people look at the message, we wanted to make sure it got out as soon as possible. And so that was something that we'll fully own, and I'll own specifically here in DEM, my fault for missing the word mile, which was a pretty critical word in that message. But we did have the two, part of that process is including multiple descriptors. So we had the address, we had the length south of that address, as well as the two streets we were evacuating between. But in just trying to get that message out as quickly as possible, that was an oversight on our part. I will say I am content in terms of getting that message out quickly. The request from on-scene command came at about, I believe it was 4:35. We talked with law enforcement, developed a strategy for notifying folks directly, and then had the IPAWS and NICSL activated just 13 minutes after that request came out. So we do want to try to strike the balance between making sure it's properly edited and vetted and clear and getting it out quickly. So something we'll improve on in the future, but under the circumstances, we did what we had to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was certainly able to decipher it, but happened to be around a lot of folks who maybe are less digitally inclined. Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, scared and confused. And so it's just a constant effort to try to communicate clearly. That I'd never heard the character count limit, which mm-hmm. that's going to be challenging. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. It's good to have a emergency management department that's been through the crucible a couple times, battle worn.
Hopefully no more crucibles, though, please.
Well, and I think it's important just to pause for just a second. And there's been a lot more, you know, fire activity, and there's a lot more caution needed right now. It's very dry out there, and just hope that we don't have a flare up, but a little flurry of flat fires in the next month or so. But appreciate the work and putting the systems in place, because I assume we're going to need them in the future.
Again, thank you, Willie. All right, well, we'll turn it over to Dr. Berry. Thanks for joining us this morning, Dr. Berry. How are we doing?
Hello there. Thank you, Willie, for kicking us off today. So today we'll talk a little bit about just viral activity, because we got actually a decent number of questions on the topic today. So we'll start on COVID. And then we also heard a little bit about RSV in our questions this year, especially with the new vaccine approved. So we'll talk a bit about that as well. So on the COVID-19 front, nationally, you might be hearing reports we're seeing increased levels of COVID-19 in wastewater at the national level. And we're also seeing a small rise in hospitalizations in people over the age of 70. So all of that together suggests that we are seeing an increase in activity at the national level. Thankfully, we are not yet seeing that here in Washington State. Our wastewater levels have been relatively stable, and we're not seeing any significant increase in hospitalizations, which is all very hopeful on our end. In Jefferson County, we also are not seeing a rise in wastewater detections of COVID-19. We did see an increase in July, but that has now resolved. And we have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19 and no new deaths to report since our last Board of Health meeting. At that meeting, we did report one additional death to bring us to a total of 40, which was actually an individual in their 90s who was actually unvaccinated. So COVID-19 remains a risk for people, especially people over 70 who have underlying conditions. So if you've made it this far without getting vaccinated, we strongly recommend that you do. In neighboring Clallam County, we also have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19 and no new deaths to report, for a total of 174 deaths so far in this response. At this point, the variant mix that we are seeing is still predominantly XBB. There are a wide variety of XBB subvariants, but they're all part of the Omicron family. And that's been really quite persistent over the last year. You might see various news reports. I know I saw some about someone in Indonesia who had the most mutated variant. And I want to encourage everyone not to let individual news reports get you too concerned. When it comes to the virus, the thing that it needs to succeed is it needs to be more transmissible. And we're really not seeing any significant surge in a new subvariant at this time. It's still all XBB,
this is which KPTZ is good from our perspective. In Port Townsend.
We are looking at a release of a new COVID-19 booster in this fall, which will be specifically for the XBB subvariant to keep everybody's immunity up as we move into the fall season. If we do expect that to come out around September or October. So if you haven't gotten your updated bivalent and you're not in a very high risk group, at this point, it would make sense to wait until the most updated booster comes out. If you are in a very high risk group, say you're getting chemotherapy, if you're over 70 of multiple underlying conditions, then it might be worthwhile to just get some more immunity on board. But for most of us, we're going to wait until the fall to move forward with getting our next booster. And this fall, we will have three vaccines available if you are over the age of 60, which is the flu vaccine, COVID-19, and RSV. And we'll get to the RSV end of the world shortly. I want to take a minute to answer some of the COVID-19 related questions that came in to us. And then we can get into the RSV realm and answer any other COVID questions first. One question we got was around COVID-19 vaccines and mammograms. Someone called to schedule their mammogram, and they recommended that they got a recommendation to schedule around their COVID-19 vaccine, and they were wondering what the heck, what's the story there? And so one key thing to know is that COVID-19 has no association with breast cancer. When you see mammogram and COVID-19 together, that can be concerning. What it is any vaccine you get can in some cases cause what's called lymphadenopathy, which is a swelling of your lymph nodes. In fact, any virus can cause lymphadenopathy. Many of us are probably used to the lymphadenopathy that comes beneath your chin if you get a cold. Same thing can actually happen in your armpit after getting a vaccine. And it's actually a good thing. It's that your body's immune system is starting to fight that virus and get prepared. And so you might get what's called transient lymphadenopathy, or swelling of the lymph nodes in your armpit. Ideally, you don't want that at the same time that you're getting your mammogram, because it could confuse the results. So if at all possible, it's ideal to get your mammogram before you get your vaccine. However, both of those things are really important. And after years of navigating COVID-19 and the vaccines for it, our local radiologists are really good at telling the difference between those two things. And so we don't want you to delay either. If you really need your mammogram right now, or you really need your vaccine right now, don't delay either of them. And just tell your radiologist when you got your vaccine, and they'll bring that into their decision-making around what they see on your mammogram. Another question came in, actually late-breaking question came to me on Friday, on antigen tests. There was a recent Nature article looking at the efficacy of antigen tests that's got some folks a little bit nervous. And in that article, they talked about the efficacy of antigen tests in catching what are commonly, in some provinces, referred to as asymptomatic cases. And so in order to understand what they found in this article, we have to scale back to talk a little bit about asymptomatic cases of COVID-19. That got a lot of play early on in the pandemic. We talked a lot about asymptomatic cases of COVID-19. But one interesting thing was actually found locally when we were doing very intensive contact tracing in Jefferson and Clallam County. What we continuously found was these asymptomatic cases of COVID didn't go on to give it to anyone else. And that was very curious. And as we looked further and further into that, and as antigen tests came out, we realized that most of these, what we thought of were asymptomatic cases, were actually past cases that were still testing positive on the PCR. So as we know, when you get a PCR, you can test positive for 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes even longer, but you no longer are infectious to other people. And so when you see an article that says that antigen tests are missing asymptomatic cases, what they're actually missing is past cases, which is actually what we want them to do. Antigen tests are a really good proxy for how contagious you are to other people. And so we don't really care from a contagiousness standpoint if you had COVID 2-3 months ago. That can be important for other diagnostic reasons in your physician's office, but antigen tests are primarily to see if you can give COVID-19 to other people. So they're still very good. One finding in that Nature article was very important and true, though, which is that antigen tests work best if you do them more than once, particularly spread out by 48 hours. Excuse me, we have a puppy who's chewing on a plant behind me. So I apologize for any distraction there. So if you have new symptoms and you take an antigen test and it's negative, do take it again, ideally 48 hours later. If you have two negatives 48 hours apart, one thing they found in that study, which is true, is it's 93% sensitive. So it's going to catch the vast majority of cases. And if you have two negatives, you're probably good to go. We still recommend that you stay home if you're sick, if you can. And if you can't, mask up if you have to be around others. And if you do all that, you're very unlikely to infect other people. One other kind of general question we got was, why aren't we better at fighting viruses? Why don't we have treatments? You know, if you have a cold, that can actually be a really terrible experience. Why can't we fix that? And is it just about money? What's going on there? And the primary issue there is actually that these viruses mutate so quickly. And so treatments are incredibly difficult for many, many viruses. However, we also have many good treatments against quite a few viruses. So measles, HPV, hepatitis B. We've got excellent vaccines for all of those things and COVID-19. So the best protection against these kind of viruses is actually the vaccine. The treatments available for these are very limited because of that rapid mutation of these viruses. This person also had a kind of a bad viral infection. It wasn't COVID. They're not quite sure what virus it was. And they wanted to know if that virus can continue to damage their body after they're no longer contagious. And one unfortunate thing that we did learn with COVID is the concept of long COVID or prolonged symptoms after a viral infection. That can happen with other viruses too, but it really depends on what kind of virus you're talking about in order to know for sure if that's a possibility. COVID does that much more often than other viruses that we know. Long COVID is much more common than prolonged symptoms after other viruses, but things like myocarditis from a viral infection have long been known to be possible. They're just much less common with other viruses than we see with COVID. So before we move into the RSV realm, I wanted to see if we have any questions about COVID from our commissioners.
Heidi, Kate, any questions?
No, I'm hearing a few more people, you know, I feel like I'm hearing about it a little bit more again in the community. So sounds.
Yeah, I'm here to personify the national uptick in COVID tested positive on Friday.
I'm sorry.
So, you know, it's mild for me. It's an excuse to pull out the PlayStation, honestly, but.
not during public session, to be clear.
So it is still here. And often we see that Washington State follows other parts of the country. So we tend to see an uptick in the East Coast and the Midwest before we see it here, which to us suggests that we're likely to see an increase in COVID-19 in the next month or so. Thankfully, that should be right around the time that we start seeing the new COVID-19 booster available. We likely won't have enough upfront for everyone, and we'll be prioritizing that vaccine for people 65 and over or people who are immunosuppressed. But we can expect to see that come around September and then October likely for the rest of us.
My only question coming out of this experience is about testing. I mean, we're lucky enough to have a huge store of tests, and I had a really, really mild cold symptoms, so tested and got a very positive line. And my family's been negative throughout the weekend, but we've gone through, you know, three boxes of tests to see if the rest of the family can go. And I'm just not sure what's going to happen once those tests are gone, except that people like my father had a cold at the same time. And he was like, because of me, he tested, but otherwise he would not have tested. And if I'm, you know, shelling out $20 for a couple of tests, I'm less likely to test for every little cold. So how can we preserve the slack going forward to stay vigilant on our, you know, COVID sentinel surveillance?
Yeah, that is a worry for us too, especially as funding dries up. You know, COVID-19 tests are not free. And especially for people with limited incomes, that can weigh into your decision making about whether or not you're going to do it. We do still have COVID-19 tests available at the department, and we are trying to prioritize those to folks who can't afford to buy their own. But there will likely come a time where those run out too. We are still going to keep enough for congregate settings, shelters, long-term care facilities, and we are going to still have COVID-19 tests for schools. But there will likely come a time where those free tests go away for the general public. My only hope is that the powers that be might fund cheaper tests for the public going forward. But so far, we're still waiting for that. I think if you do have a good store in your house, it is probably worthwhile saving it for when you're symptomatic and keeping that 48-hour space between when you take another one, just to save your tests.
Even for folks that are, so like my wife that didn't have any symptoms, she should only do it every 48 hours as well to see if she's...
Well, and if she's asymptomatic, if she's not going into a very high-risk space, she can actually just go and wear a mask. And so to spare your tests, that's another option. However, if she, say, works in a long-term care facility, they're going to recommend more stringent testing for her to reduce the risk of bringing COVID-19 into a high-risk space. But you can actually just go about your day. But if, say, your husband has COVID and you have new runny nose, I would assume that you have COVID and act accordingly.
But if an antigen test tells you that you're negative, does that mean that you might have COVID but are not contagious? I mean, with the properties that you described earlier?
Sure. So you may not be contagious yet. However, you may become contagious in the next 48 hours. So that's why we wear a mask when we're around others. If you're symptomatic and you have someone in your house who has COVID, the best thing to do is to stay home. But if that's not accessible to you and you're negative on an antigen test, you could potentially go out in the world with your mask on.
Great. And then the last question, and I swear I'm done, is my family members were, you know, symptom free. And so really went, I isolated from them as well as from the rest of the world. And they pretty much went on with their business, which is the recommendation at this point, right? I just wanted to confirm that course for the public.
That is the recommendation. If you have a household contact, it used to be, we would say you had to quarantine. However, we have so much accumulated population immunity that it's not a guarantee that you're going to get it at this point. If you have a household contact, especially if they test early and isolate early. So gosh, just a few months ago in my household, we had a household contact that was positive, but thankfully they tested early and we were able to isolate them, and I never got it and my daughter never got it. And that was really, you know, that showed the benefit of the immunity that we've accumulated primarily through vaccine in my family. And so that makes a big difference. We don't see it running through families the way we used to.
Is the testing flowchart on the public health website, is that current and still something you recommend people use as a resource?
It should be. I will double check it, but it should be up to date. And basically, that'll tell you when to test and when to isolate or quarantine. And generally, we don't really quarantine anymore. We only isolate people who are symptomatic at this point.
And it refers you to the State Department of Health, but it's still.
Okay, great. One question, Dr. Barry, what are the epidemiologists saying, kind of predicting for this fall? Just if you had a crystal ball, what would you guess our trajectory will be in terms of COVID?
So we are expecting a surge come fall. That's just a time when people gather, school's back in session. And so we expect to see more transmission come fall. I'd be very surprised if we don't see that. And so we'll likely see flu, RSV, and COVID all at the same time. The one hopeful thing is that the amount of accumulated population immunity we have means that the COVID that we see in the fall, we are less likely to see as much severe disease as we've seen before. Not because the virus is any less severe than it was, but because we've built up immunity. What made COVID so dangerous in the last 3 years was that none of us were immune to it. But now many of us have built up some immunity, so we're likely to see a surge. And it is likely to still be risky for high-risk folks. So folks who have immunosuppression, particularly, unfortunately, folks who are on chemotherapy, and people who are over 65 and have underlying conditions still pose a risk. The one other group that we don't talk enough about is newborn babies who don't have immunity. If you're under 6 months, you've never seen COVID before and you've not had a vaccine. And so that risk is very real for that population. And so taking care to protect the tiniest members of our community and those at high risk because of their medical problems will be important coming into the fall. And that means if you're in any of those groups, any of the older groups, wearing a high quality mask when you're indoors come fall is really important. And staying home when you're sick is a really important way to protect the other people in your life. And being very thoughtful if you're going to be around newborn babies, wearing a mask if you're going to be around them, and not showing up if you're sick, because their immune systems are not ready to fight the viruses that we see in the fall, including COVID-19.
Thank you.
All right.
I guess RSV time.
Yeah, so we got a good question about RSV. And so RSV has been a little bit more in the news lately. It certainly was in the news last winter when we were seeing big surges in pediatric hospitalizations due to RSV. One thing we probably didn't talk enough about in that time period is RSV can be very dangerous for little children and for people over 60. It's kind of an inverse bell. It's a U-shape. We see high rates of hospitalization for the elderly and for the very young. Every year, we see about 60 to 100,000 hospitalizations in people over 60 in the United States for RSV. And we actually see about 6 to 10,000 die due to RSV in that age group as well. And of course, as we talked about a lot last year, we see a surge in hospitalizations in the very young as well. Thankfully, this fall, we have some new tools to fight RSV. Particularly, we have an RSV vaccine that was approved for everyone 60 and up, and is highly recommended if you're 60 or older to get vaccinated for RSV, because you don't want to get severe disease or get hospitalized or in rare instances, die due to RSV. The other important tool that we have that was approved was a monoclonal antibody for newborn babies. It's called nirsevimab, or Beyfortus is the brand name of that, and it was just approved and should be available this fall. It's particularly for newborn babies coming into RSV season, or newborns who were born in RSV season. It is also available for kids up to age 2 who are at very high risk of RSV, and that's particularly premature kiddos, kids with chronic lung or heart disease in the 0 to 2 bracket. That's a smaller group, and parents will know if they're in that group. They will be eligible for that monoclonal antibody as well. Many of us have heard about monoclonal antibodies when it comes to COVID-19. This is actually just an injection. It's going to look a lot like a vaccine. It's not an IV in your kit. In that discussion around monoclonals, I think there might be some confusion because this person who was writing was thinking of maybe that it was a treatment for RSV. It's not. Those are all preventative measures. We don't have a focused treatment for RSV at this time, which is why we also don't have a test that's widely available for RSV. So you can't go to your doctor and say, hey, I want a test, and there's not an available antigen test for RSV. We do test for RSV when people are hospitalized. Particularly, actually, we do it at children's hospitals so that we can make sure that kids with RSV don't get put in the same ward as folks who have heart disease, for example, so we don't spread RSV in those spaces, but it's not widely available for the general public. But we are very excited to have some more tools for RSV. Every fall, RSV has overwhelmed our pediatric hospital system and led to a surge in hospitalization of our elders as well. And so we're very hopeful that having this monoclonal antibody and these vaccines available can help us really reduce that rate of hospitalization this fall, and give us put us in a much better stead going into the fall. I'm very hopeful about it. So if you're in one of those groups, if you're over 60, or if you have a newborn baby coming into this fall, we expect to have both of these available. The vaccines are actually available now. And so you could get your RSV vaccine, your flu vaccine, and your updated COVID vaccine, and you can get them all together. The updated COVID vaccine isn't quite available yet. And we don't generally recommend getting your RSV vaccine until it gets a little closer to fall, so you have some good coverage. But you can get all three of those in probably September or October, so that you don't have to get hospitalized with any of those viruses. Any questions about RSV? Okay. And then last question I got was actually about our talk from last time, when we talked about harm reduction and fentanyl in particular. So this person was asking about fentanyl in the medical context. And so yes, fentanyl is regularly used in surgeries because of its rapid onset and coming off. So that's for generalized anesthesia, we'll use fentanyl, or for sometimes in what's called conscious sedation, they'll use fentanyl as well. This person was asking if that's also used in dental surgery, and it is. It's very common in dental surgery, particularly wisdom teeth. That's a time that you'll see fentanyl used. But these are all cases where you have someone, you have an anesthesiologist managing your airway and making sure that you're using they're giving you just the right amount, and that they can help you come back if you look too sedated, where they have oxygen available and ways to make sure that you are adequately ventilated. That is very different than the fentanyl that we see on the street. And in fact, this person was asking, how do they make sure that the fentanyl in healthcare systems is not contaminated? Thankfully, the fentanyl we use in the healthcare system is very distinct from the fentanyl that you see on the street. It is highly, highly regulated, and it's a medication just like anything else. So it's manufactured in normal processes the way we make Tylenol or other medications that you might use. So we know exactly what's in it. That's not the same as the kind of pills you get on the street, where we have no idea how much fentanyl's in it or even what drugs are in it. So you can trust that if you're getting fentanyl from an anesthesiologist in the doctor, that is in the doctor's office, that is what that is. It's a very, very different than the kind of thing you'll see on the street. And most importantly, it's given in a regulated environment where we know exactly how much you're getting and where we can manage your airway and make sure that you're breathing. It's very different than what we see on the street. The only other thing I want to give you all an update on the viral front is that on the public health end, we've been spending a lot of energy on a highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak on Rat Island. You guys may have heard a bit about this, especially if you follow our social media. Unfortunately, we've seen around 1,300 birds die of highly pathogenic avian influenza on that island, and we've seen some wash up on neighboring beaches. There's been a lot of energy put into this. Thankfully, we've seen no human cases, though we have followed some humans that were involved in that cleanup effort, and we've seen no other mammal cases of avian influenza. We have had other cases in other parts of the country where it's spread to seals, but we haven't seen that here. We have tested some seals to make sure. The reason why we put all this energy into avian influenza, even though it's predominantly animal virus, is to keep it from becoming a human virus. We don't want to, this is actually kind of all around pandemic prevention. The big thing that happened with COVID was a virus went from animals to people, and then the last 3 years happened. And so I just wanted folks to know that we are kind of always working in the background to make sure that that doesn't happen here. And one of the places where we do that kind of work is when it comes to avian influenza, to make sure that it doesn't spread from birds to people. And so if you are spending time at Fort Flagler, we're asking folks not to go to Rat Island, but if you're nearby, if you're in boats and you see dead birds, please don't interact with them. Please don't touch them. You can put in a message to the WDFW to make sure that they are aware that that birds are washing up. And if you see dead birds in other areas, we are starting to see some spillover into the wild bird population more generally from that outbreak. And so if you see dead birds, please report them, but please don't touch them. We don't want to have any crossover between this virus and people to the extent that we can. Thankfully, we haven't seen that yet. And all of our community can work together to make sure that it doesn't spread by not interacting interacting with dead birds that you see. And if you have poultry, making sure that your poultry are not interacting with wild birds to the extent that you can. Keeping them separate, especially from waterfowl, can help protect your chickens and ducks from picking up avian influenza. With that, that's all I have today. Any other questions from our team?
Packed update. Thank you, Dr. Berry. Any questions for Dr. Berry?
Nope, not here.
I guess we got a couple more minutes. I'll just, thanks for the details on avian flu and the exhortation to stay away from any, injured or dead birds at this point and just report them. On the harm reduction question, you know, I've been reading the grim New York Times article about Portland and some of the other impacts and, you know, was in Seattle last week. And I guess I'm just wondering, it feels a little bit like we're at a point that we need to add more ingredients to this social gumbo. I mean, it feels like we're being overwhelmed by the issues right now. And I'm wondering, and harm reduction, I know it's not a passive action, but it is action, but what else can we do?
Sure. No, there's a lot we can do. So yes, read that article too, about what's going on in Portland. And I would say one piece of this puzzle that is often missing in these discussions, I often hear folks talk about, you know, what's happening to these cities. We're seeing all these people outside who are using drugs. And often the finger is pointed at decriminalization for what caused that. But looking with a keen eye to controls and lack thereof, one of the things that I see is that we're seeing a rise in public drug use all across the country, including in towns where it was not decriminalized. And so I think pointing to Portland as decriminalization as driving that, I think is not entirely, doesn't seem accurate based on the data that we have available. What is most likely leading to the rise in public drug use is a concomitant rise in homelessness. People don't use drugs in public if they have an indoor place to use drugs in. No one wants to shoot up in the park. The only reason you're using in the park is because you don't have an indoor space that's available to you. And so if we really want to stem the tide of public drug use or drug use generally, we need to have a very focused effort on these upstream social factors. One thing I commonly hear is the idea that drug use leads to homelessness. But when we've looked at it at a cause-effect level, one of the most common, it's actually the other way around. You are more likely to use drugs if you've recently become homeless. It's a terrible life experience. It's traumatic to be homeless. And many people particularly start using meth because it keeps them awake, it keeps them warm, and it makes them less hungry. That makes sense if you live outside. And if we could do a better job at keeping people inside, warm and fed, that might not happen. And so if we really want to change the direction of drug use, in addition to harm reduction, in addition to making treatment available, in addition to promoting safe prescribing and not excessive opiate prescriptions, we also have to work upstream to keep people indoors and keep them fed and do what we can to minimize the trauma that moves them into drug use in the first place. I think if we as a society decided to do that and invest the kind of money it would take to do that, we could turn this around. But I don't think it's that a bunch of people just decided they didn't care. And so now we got to be harder on them to make them care. I think we need to deal with why people start using drugs. And if we do that, I think we can turn it around.
I appreciate that. And we had a great ICG conversation with Greg Colburn a couple of weeks ago that we should get a link out to folks because it dispelled a lot of those canards about, decriminalizing, creating the situation. And I think housing first, I think we have a consensus in Jefferson County on pursuing that. But it does seem like another thing that has changed is the availability, the onslaught of fentanyl and the sea change that addictive drug has wreaked in the drug using community. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it too.
Oh, for sure. Having fentanyl available is really changing the game. It's so available and it's so dangerous. One hopeful sign that I see here is there's a common thought that we're seeing more people using drugs, but so far, when we look at, for instance, our opiate use among young people, we're actually seeing less than we were before. And so I'm not sure that we actually have compelling data. In fact, I know that we don't have compelling data that more people are using drugs, but what we do have data on is that it's really terrible for the people who are. And so how do we support them, and how do we keep people from moving into that life going forward? And I think demand reduction is a big part of where we focus our effort in public health, but supply reduction, I think there's a valid point to be made there. I have a lot of patients who are trying really hard to get sober, and it's really hard to get sober when there's fentanyl all around you. And so removing some of that would, I'm sure, make a difference. The challenge is just, how do you do it? And I know that our law enforcement officers are working very hard on how to manage that, because it's a hard problem to solve.
Great. Well, thank you for that, those considerations. Okay, well, it is 10:30 according to my clock. So thank you, Dr. Barry. Thank you, Willie, for the data-filled updates. And we will say goodbye to the listeners from KPTZ and move on with our regular day. Well, we might see you later.